In the tennis world in May, all roads lead from Rome to Paris for the second Grand Slam tournament of the year. Hello, I'm Chris Bowers, and a very warm welcome to you wherever in the world you may be. And it is warm in Paris, 24 degrees in the eve of the tournament. I am sitting just under the lip of the Philippe Chatrier Arena, out of the sun, because if you're in the sun, you need the sun cream. And the weather forecast is set well for the first week. We're at Roland Garros, home of the French Open. It's a tournament that actually doesn't have an official English name. The French name for many years was Internationaux de France, which translates as the French Internationals. And these days, the French Tennis Federation prefers the event to be known as Roland Garros, but for many, it is best known under its nickname, the French Open. Alongside me on the eve of, well, Roland Garros or the French Open, whichever you prefer, is a former top 30 player who grew up on the red clay of Central Europe, Tamira Paszek. Tamira, lovely to have you with us. When you walk through the gates of Roland Garros, what does this immensely prestigious 95-year-old venue do for you?
Well, it gives you that extra special feeling walking through the gates, just the whole environment. You see the crowd, the stands, the red clay. It's just this magnificent quality of clay that you get in no other place than Roland Garros.
I should congratulate you on getting back into the world's top 500. It's a slow process when your ranking's gone into four figures, but we'll come back to that a little bit later. You're still on the media side rather than back on the player side, at least for the first week of Roland Garros. And the big story for the media and for everybody else in the lead-up to this fortnight is that for the first time since 2004, Rafael Nadal will not be in the starting lineup. For you, how does that change the tournament?
It does change the whole environment, the whole vibe is different. Like, the king of clay is missing this year, but what to do? Times change, and it's an extremely sad moment, I think, also for Rafa to have had to take this decision, but he prioritized his body and his health, and now we're here at Roland Garros, and I think we have fantastic tennis, we have great players out there, and it's going to be a very, very interesting tournament.
You see, I'm more relaxed about Nadal not being here than I would have been if it had happened 5 years ago. I mean, partly because I was predicting during his 20s that he wouldn't play into his 30s, because the way he plays takes such a toll on his body. And 5 years ago, when we still had Nadal, Djokovic, Federer at the top, it would perhaps have been a big hole. But for a start, last year, I mean, it's amazing that he won this tournament, having had to have injections in his foot before all of his seven matches. I mean, I'm not even sure whether that's a good thing to do, but let's leave that aside, because I have so much admiration for the man that I don't want to go down that particular road. But I don't think we should be surprised that he's not here, and he is not here at a time when we have so many really interesting players, the obvious one being Alcaraz. But Alcaraz and Djokovic could be a fantastic generation game in the semi-finals. Medvedev is playing really well. Rune's coming good this year. Surely it's as good a time as any not to have Rafa.
Definitely. And as you just mentioned, it was bound to happen at some point in his career that he will miss Roland Garros. And it's this year, and we have a lot of young upcoming players. Rune has played some outstanding tennis over the last couple of weeks on clay. Tsitsipas, Alcaraz, obviously a huge favorite for me personally at this tournament. So very, very interesting lineup.
Well, we'll come in a minute to who's most likely to benefit from Nadal's absence. But understandably, Nadal has been a huge talking point in the build-up to Roland Garros. And Ersin Kaderas asked one of the leading lights, Stefanos Tsitsipas, what tennis is without Rafa?
I really don't know how to answer that. He definitely offers a lot to our sport. And when he's around, you can feel his presence and his energy and how hard he works for every point. And his spirit, the spirit that he puts out on the court, is an example. You know, you would like to see players like this more often on the tennis court, because they bring out the best out of your tennis. And it's more of the Ubuntu sort of philosophy, where once one person's success or excellence can actually help you and push you towards becoming better yourself. And I really believe in that, truly. So having him around is definitely good for our sport. It's good for me as well, because I get to play more time against him. I get the opportunity to learn even more. We have someone that looks a little bit like him, which is Carlos Alcaraz, in terms of how he gets to every ball on the court and how he covers pretty much the half of the planet when he plays. So they have a lot of similarities, and I think he could be the next Rafael Nadal of our tennis.
That's interesting. So if having Rafa around is good for Tsitsipas, is it good news for Stefanos that Nadal isn't here, or bad news?
A bit of both, I would say. On one hand, it's always good when you have these top players around, and especially someone you've admired for so long, and you raise your own level. On the other hand, as we've mentioned earlier, there are a lot of players that play at a top level, so I think he won't have any issues in raising his game, no matter who he plays.
And what about his suggestion there that Alcaraz could be the next Nadal? I mean, I suppose one has to qualify how he sees that, but do you see Alcaraz as the next Nadal?
Well, knowing that Alcaraz really doesn't like to be compared to Rafa because he sees himself as the individual on his own path, on his own journey, but I do see the point of Stefanos Tsitsipas saying that, referring to clay, he could be the next Nadal, definitely.
He could dominate the way Nadal has dominated, but for me, Alcaraz has more about him. Again, I'm being very careful not to be too comparing of him with Nadal. Nadal has his own style of play, which is admirable, but I feel there's a lot more in Alcaraz's game. You see Alcaraz at the net far more than you ever see Nadal, even on clay.
And to me, honestly, when I watch Alcaraz play, it looks a bit less physical. It looks effortless. It looks light how he moves around the court, how he just takes those right decisions. The shot play comes to the net at the right time. He's got it all. He's got the entire package, the whole game. Each and every shot just looks perfect when he plays.
He's a great thinker as well. Whenever he has difficulties, so much in his game, you think, okay, that's the kind of player who's going to mature later, to work out when they're going to use all the elements of his game, in particular the drop shots and the angles that he plays with. But no, he won a Grand Slam at 19, albeit with Djokovic not there, but nonetheless, it's a phenomenal achievement, and I admire as much his brain power on a tennis court as his ability to hit shots.
The thing is, at this young age, he has it all. And yeah, especially the brain power and shot selection. His mental strength is just immense.
Okay, so let's put Alcaraz as one of the top three frontline favourites. He missed the Australian Open, but he bounced back to win the titles in Buenos Aires, Indian Wells, Barcelona and Madrid. But also in the draw is Novak Djokovic, the Australian Open champion. He's projected to meet Alcaraz in the semis. And Daniil Medvedev, who's the number two seed. He's won titles in Rotterdam, Doha, Dubai, Miami and, impressively, last week in Rome. And he comes to Paris as well, number two, as we said. Of those three, can you see all of them winning? Obviously,
yes.
Only one will, but do you see any of them winning?
Interestingly, looking back at the last few years, no one would have picked Medvedev as the winner. He is now in an outstanding form, won his first tournament on clay, so I do think he can go very far and have a deep run in the tournament. Can he make it? Yeah, why not? He's got the confidence, he's got the game. He's sliding really well on clay, which he hasn't been doing the last few years. So I think that's a huge plus point.
See, that's always been the baffling thing for me. Medvedev, we've known, hasn't played well on clay. I could never see why. The only reason was between his ears. He has a French coach. He lives in France. He plays a lot on clay. Why has it taken him this long?
Well, sometimes you don't know why or what the reason is, and then it just happens. But I'm sure they've put in a lot of work off the court as well in getting, you know, the momentum in, the sliding routine. He said after Madrid, after that loss, he spent a lot of hours on court trying to slide, recover from those shots that go into the corner of the court, and it paid off in Rome, and I'm seeing him in great form.
I mean, you grew up on clay, but prefer the hard courts. Did you ever go through a sort of crisis of confidence on clay?
Yes, I did, and I still do up to date. It's just a higher bounce, and Medvedev is one of the players that plays super flat for men's tennis. And I think that has been the biggest factor for him to progressing on clay, just to get that right timing of timing that flat shot, recovering into the middle, and it's just a lot more physical on clay, and that's what I felt suited me better, were the quicker courts, the bounce was lower, and it's just easier to time when you play flat.
What about Djokovic? He's not been in great form of late. There's possibly an elbow problem that he's keeping close, within his group. I mean, I've learned to be suspicious of his injuries because he's won two Australian titles, 21 and 23, with injuries which, at face value, he should not have been able to play, let alone win the title. For me, if he is remotely fit, being at a Grand Slam tournament, he will hit a level that he hasn't hit on the tour in recent weeks.
Novak at a Slam is a different Novak. He just outgrows himself and the capability, whether he's injured or not. We've seen it at the Australian Open. There is no stopping him. And no matter how he has played in the last few weeks, they asked him in Rome, are you still confident for Paris? His answer was a clear yes. Why wouldn't he? I mean, he's up there. He's one of the greatest players of all time. And I see him making a deep run for sure.
So we've covered Alcaraz, Djokovic and Medvedev. One name we didn't include there was Holger Rune. If you heard last week's ATP podcast, you'll have heard the first in a two-part in-depth look at the feisty but impressive Dane. So here's the second part, brought to you by our colleagues at ATP Uncovered. And it features the voices of many of Rune's family, obviously the young man himself, and his coach, Lars Christensen.
He's always found inspiration in a lot of the players on tour when he was younger. And when he started, Rafa was number one on the ranking. Holger was dressed up in sleeveless and bandana and woohoo. Then he played his first tournament and he was a finalist. He was the winner and he went bananas. And we tried to, you know, calm him down and say, it's okay and go take your trophy. So we had to take it home in the bag. And when he came to his room, he said, take down Rafa. At that time, Rafa was number two and Roger was number one. And he said, put up Roger. And then he changed his outfit. He was in polo, he was in Wilson bracket. Everything was changed. And he said, I never want to be number two. It's the worst.
It might be good enough for some players, but I've always wanted to be number one in everything I do.
Holger, would you describe yourself as a perfectionist?
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. I am, especially on the practice court. Match court, not as much, which is good.
Why do you say it's good that you're not a perfectionist on the match court?
Because I feel like on the match, it's not about how it looks and how you hit the ball. It's more about finding solution to win. If you feel it well, it's great. If you don't, you still have to win. So you have to find solution. And if you're a perfectionist and try to hit that perfect shot while you're not playing well, I mean, it's just a matter of time before you lose. I look a little bit on who I'm playing tactically. We talk a little bit before the match and how I'm going to play and how I'm going to, you know, do mentally in this match. But then I try to put very little focus on the opponent because he's doing his thing. It's about me and how I'm going to handle this. And then I just go for it and try to play the tennis on my terms. And when I do that, I have a big chance to win. I've been better to be calm in important moments because if you're stressed out, it's tough to make the shots that you want to make. We all feel the pressure, but I like it. I mean, I handle it well, sometimes I don't, but I try to do it as best as I can.
Magical tennis.
You know, on the court, it's cool to see a good fight, and almost all of the men's players, when you finish the match, they're a good battle man, and then you move on. I think this is very good for tennis.
It's nice to go to the trusted team, but I think the tour has a good energy.
I would say it's not just one thing, it's a lot of things. It's tennis things, mental things, physical things. You know, it just all added up together and got to another level. That came because I really worked hard every day. You know, they don't come overnight. It comes slowly and all of a sudden it's clicking and it did that in the end of the season.
It's a moment that he's worked so hard for, him and his coach, his family.
There is not like one point where you say, wow, now you can become a professional tennis player.
Of course you believe in your kids, but it's during the process you see it. And it's getting more and more real.
I read a quote from you saying, one day I will be number one. What gives you that confidence?
I am obsessed with tennis, for sure. If you want to be the greatest player that you can be and you don't breathe the sport, I don't think it's possible.
Want to become the very best in your sport? You're never going to reach it if you don't have that drive. I mean, everybody can have a good career in sports, but they're never going to be world number one. It's not going to happen in any sport. So you have to be a little bit, call it crazy, or you have to be super ambitious and you really have to believe it.
Where do you think that drive and that obsession comes from? And do you think it's something that you get from your family or something else from within?
I mean, it must come from somewhere. You know, this energy, I mean, my mom has a very big will in everything she goes into and has helped me a lot on the way. She knows me so well to put me in the right mental stage to compete. And, you know, it's important to build the right team for you, and everybody's different. Everybody needs different persons. And I feel like I have built a very good team. I have super supportive coaches, family, and I'm very proud of how we're all developing. I don't think about tennis 24/7, but I think about what's necessary for my tennis 24/7. So I make the choices for my tennis, not the other way around. So if you see it that way, I do, yeah. You know, it's kind of built who I am, if you can say so, because without tennis, I'm sure I wouldn't have the same mentality as I have today. So I thank tennis a lot. You know, you feel different every day, and you're not as happy every day when you wake up. So you gotta stay disciplined, and the discipline is one of the most important thing. That if you train good one day, it matters, but it doesn't really matter. I gotta see on the big picture that I have a big dream, and no matter how I feel, I wanna reach that dream. And the dream means more than how I feel on that certain day.
He has a plan A and a goal. He never really had a plan B, so it's all or nothing. He just goes completely for it.
I'm very young and I have the right people around me, so I feel like this is gonna be it. You know, I'm gonna keep doing this way. I don't know how to explain it. It was crazy. It was a crazy feeling. I was like, oh my God, I'm gonna hit with the big guys in the world. I mean, it can't get any better than this.
2 years ago was a highlight, 2 years ago was a highlight, last year was a highlight. You know, every time is like winning his first 25, winning his first ATP Challenger. So if Paris, yes, it was, you know, the biggest tournament so far, but if we look at where Holger were at that time, the challenges 2 years ago were just as big for me as the Masters, and the next step will be the Grand Slam. It will be big as well, but in my heart, and when I see the work behind and the feelings behind, the challenger was as big as the Masters 1000.
It's never going to be a new Roger, new Rafa, new Novak. There's going to be a new player of a new person, so it's really important to keep your identity, and that's what I'm trying to do.
Holger is Holger, and he doesn't really try to be something he's not, and he's not scared to like show his character and show who he is.
I want to be a legend. You know, I want to be remembered as a great player, a great person, and a great athlete.
You're working your way there.
Yeah, I am.
The immensely confident but still level-headed Holger Rune. Tamira, in that feature he said, "I'm obsessed with tennis." How healthy is that?
Healthy and not healthy at the same time. I mean, I always see it very tricky if things go well, and obviously you need the right amount of focus and addiction for the game and the passion to do the job day in, day out, to practice on days where you really don't want to get up, on days where you're sore, you have to overcome your own boundaries. But on the other hand, what happens if you have an injury, if you're not able to do what you love doing? How healthy is that obsession? Like, does it interfere with your mental health, with your happiness? Are you making your happiness depend on results? Like, this is a whole process that comes along with it. And for me, it's always a tricky thing when someone's as good as he is at such a young age to maybe burn out a little or you know, just lose that balance.
Do you see it as a danger?
Right now, not at all, because he seems healthy, he seems happy, he seems well covered with the entire team around
and the
him,
results are going in the right direction.
Exactly. But what happens if at some point, you know, it's one of his first years on the tour, playing constantly, being in the top 10, expectation rises. But let's hope everything goes well for him and that he still remains with his inner balance and that everything works out.
I found it also interesting that his coach Lars Christensen said that he felt the challenger tournaments were as important 2 years ago as the Masters 1000s are now, if not more important. I suppose that emphasizes just how important each step up the lower reaches of the tour really is.
Totally, Chris. I mean, tennis got so much more competitive. Many, many years ago, you played someone in the top 500 and you were like, okay, you know, I'll get through this match even if I'm not 100%. This is not happening. Right now, all of the top 200, 300, 400 players on the Challenger Tour, they play some seriously great tennis. And they're the small details which, you know, which then decides the close moments in the matches. And that's why I think every step of the journey is important for the process.
What is it like for you playing, you know, tournaments, what your current ranking is around 500? What is the pressure when you have a tournament, especially if you get to, say, the semi-finals, where you know that a victory is worth an awful lot of ranking points? That must play on your mind.
Very much so, indeed, because you play for so little points at the early rounds of those tournaments and you're trying to climb up the ladder of the rankings and then you're in those positions. I mean, for me, it's been a bit of a different story because I used to play on the WTA. I used to play in big stadiums, crowd-filled stadiums, and right now the conditions are different. The ball change is different. It's not at 7 and 9. It's 11, 13, or maybe 9 and 11. So that changes the entire game. The facilities are different. Sometimes you just play with one lines judge and not the whole court covered. There are no spectators at some events. So that changes the whole environment of tennis. Someone that maybe plays well in that environment does not feel comfortable on center court at Roland Garros in Chatrier. So it's a bit of plus and minus. For me, I definitely think my game, I perform better at a place where I was used to be my whole career, like with a crowd, with a professional environment, with ball changes at a regular time, line judges, just, you know, a place where it's suited for professional sports. But that makes it a lot harder as well to climb up the rankings, getting through those stages, grinding day in, day out.
If they change the balls at 11 or 13 games, does that mean that there's a dramatic change in the nature of the game once the new balls come in?
Definitely, because you do wear them out. I mean, they fluff up a lot, especially on clay. Your elbows affected your shoulder. Like, there's a lot more work. And then you play with new balls at a crucial moment of the match and then just flies off the racket. So it does change it a bit. So playing the bigger events does help to have less of a change in within the sets and the match.
Fascinating. We went off on a slight tangent there, but I felt it was very interesting. So we've covered Rune, but if we're going to include him as, let's say, a second-tier favourite after his title in Munich and finishing runner-up in Monte Carlo and Rome, I guess we have to include the Monte Carlo champion Andre Rublev and the big-hitting Italian Jannik Sinner, who's been very consistent this year, also as second-tier favourites.
I do think that all of the ones that you mentioned right now can have a very deep run, and especially Sinner as well. I think he developed his game really well working with Darren Cahill. Has helped, you know, he seems more composed on court. Things are working out for him really well. Rublev seems in a happy place. He looks way more relaxed on court. He seems like he's having a good time. He's enjoying it. We see less of a emotional up and down when he plays. And yeah, I do think they can all go deep at this year's Roland Garros.
And there's Tsitsipas, finalist at the Australian Open and Barcelona, semi-finalist in Rome, and runner-up here 2 years ago when he led a two-sets lead slip against Djokovic. I mean, for me, this is the place where he's most likely to win his first slam, simply because he has a fraction longer to prepare for the backhand, which is a great shot, but isn't always at its best when it's being pounded.
Totally true, and it's been long in the making. It's funny, we speak about all these super young players, and then you have Tsitsipas, who is super young as well.
Mid-20s now.
He's been around for so long that, yeah, it's funny, but I do think that what you just said, it would really help his game, that he has a bit more time to set up the backhand and, you know, to hit through his shots the way he likes to do so. So why not give him a chance?
And a couple more players we haven't mentioned are Casper Ruud, last year's runner-up, Cameron Norrie. They've both been in patchy form this year. Norrie, perhaps understandable, Wimbledon semi-finalist, but he's yet to really hit the heights. But Ruud was a finalist not just here, but at the US Open last year, and he came within one match of the number one ranking. Do you get the sense that Ruud is coming good late in this year's clay court season, or is he just not playing well enough to be a factor?
No, I think he plays well. I mean, he has a super solid game, and he did well in Rome as well. Can he make it back to the finals? I think there are a couple players that will be in his way, that maybe play a bit more aggressive and have a bit more variation to the game. But you never know. Someone that's had good memories at a tournament, that always helps and gives you a positive attitude. So why not? I mean, can definitely go into the second week of the Slam. He's up there.
Okay, so time to put you on the spot. Your pick for the men's singles?
I'll go with Alcaraz.
Interesting. I'm going with Djokovic.
Okay.
I just have this feeling that Djokovic sees this as a little window where Federer and Nadal have gone, and he has that sort of psychological advantage.
Over there, on that point, I agree with you. He's dangerous. You never know at a Slam.
But it could go either way. Yes.
But it would be boring if we picked the same person.
It would be. And I have to ask you for a pick in the women's singles. Iga Świątek is top seed and just about the favourite, but she could lose her number one ranking this fortnight. And she hasn't been in as good form as she was in 2020 and 2022 when she won the title. So who are you going for in the women's?
I would maybe say definitely Świątek's up there, my number one pick. But I think someone like Sabalenka and Rybakina can be quite dangerous for her, especially if they're a bit warmer temperatures in Paris. Adds a little more speed to the game in terms of serving. Sabalenka, Rybakina, big servers, big hitters. So those three are my picks right now.
Yeah, I would love to see one of Pegula, Goff and Jabeur winning, but I don't see it happening. I would have to pick my winner from those three. And I think having one in Australia, Sabalenka, could be unleashed now. So I'm going to go with Sabalenka.
You're listening to the ATP Tennis Radio Podcast. Available on iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn and atptour.com.
One of the biggest upsets in the Roland Garros final in recent years came in 2015. With the world gathered to see Novak Djokovic complete his career Grand Slam, the Serb had the rug pulled from under his feet by a superb display by Stan Wawrinka. So well did the Swiss player that even the traditionalists forgave him his garish shorts, which looked to have been made from material resembling bathroom curtains. Wawrinka played most of his career in the shadow of the great Roger Federer, but he came good in his late 20s. So we asked him to scribble a letter to his younger self on what he'd advise young Stan, knowing what he knows now.
Well, I will give simple advice to my younger self. Keep dreaming, keep passionate about the game that you love. Don't forget it's a game you started to play to enjoy with your friends, so keep having fun. I think from young age I always put a lot of pressure on myself. I think for me it was the pressure that I put on myself that I was struggling to deal with it completely. But keep enjoying what you do, keep pushing yourself, keep trusting the process, and you know that you will get there. It takes time to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. You don't need to be always so hard on yourself. I was sometimes missing a bit of confidence in myself. I will tell him that it's part of the game, that the sooner you accept it, the sooner you deal with yourself and with it, the better you will be. From young age, I always try to learn from it. For me, failure is not negative. It's part of your career, especially in tennis. You most of the week end up losing a match, so you need to learn from it. And I think I've been doing that quite well from young age, to accept the losing, accept failure, and try to learn from it instead of being just negative about it. I knew from the beginning, and I enjoyed the hard work. I love, I've been passionate from day one, and I've been loving the process of pushing myself to the limit. I believe that I knew from young age that my talent and my way of getting to the maximum of my career will be by practicing hard, pushing myself hard, and I love that. I loved that from the beginning when I was younger. Also, I enjoyed the time on the court, off the court, in the fitness court. So for me, it was the passion of the game that pushed me to keep working harder. Maybe when I start, I would have loved to be a bit more confident with myself and believing a bit more in myself that I could reach the highest level of the sport. 2013 was a turning year for myself, especially the beginning in Australia against Novak, a match that I lost in 5 sets. But that's when I completely realized with myself that I was able to beat the top players and maybe to reach a Grand Slam final and win a Grand Slam. I think you have to keep pushing yourself anyway. You have to keep working hard, and career can be really long. So if you want to have more success, you have to keep pushing yourself and keep learning from failure and success. I had everything in me to win Grand Slam. And that maybe I could trust myself a bit more on the court and about the process.
Absolutely fascinating. But would the young Stan have believed the older Stan? That's the question. Tamira, we had Holger Rune, who's at the start of his career, saying that he's obsessed with tennis, even if he doesn't think about it 24/7. And now we've got Stan Wawrinka in the twilight of his career saying that young players need to enjoy it and accept that defeats aren't failure but something to learn from. It sort of begs the question, is there a balance here between the focus and dedication that's needed to get to the top but not to such an extent that the person behind the racket gets killed off?
That's a tough one. It's a very fine line in my opinion. And when I meet young players, I do always encourage them to, especially when they're still playing juniors, like enjoy those years. You know, the pressure will grow when you get older, when you play on the tour. But it's always tough to see that when you're in that hamster wheel, when you're doing it day in, day out, traveling from tournament to tournament, it's tough to get a rational view on things. Like, I've changed my view from the outside when not competing for 5 years. I appreciate things a lot more. I do see what I've achieved in my career, which I didn't at that point. Like, I was not happy being top 30 because you're always striving for more. You're in that competition mode all the time, 365 a year, and that's not healthy because I sometimes didn't allow myself to be happy when I had losses. And tennis is a sport that unless you win every single match the entire week, you lose once a week. You know, you're a loser once a week, and that's mentally something that you have to deal with. So I like what Stan said there, that failure is something to learn from. It's not a bad thing entirely.
So if someone had said to you when you were ranked 26, enjoy it because this is as high as it's going to get, obviously that would have been bad news at the time because you were still hoping to get higher. But would you have enjoyed it more, or is the whole mindset that gets you to number 26 in a very, very competitive global sport, does it inevitably mean you cannot enjoy it?
No, I think definitely if someone would have told me that at that moment and we could look into the future, yeah, sure, I would have enjoyed it more. On the other hand, it would be very easy to be professional athletes if we had the mindset that we had at this age that I'm now when I was, you know, 20. So it's a process of growing up, of becoming the person you are, and I think it's a process of learning, of developing.
You talk about learning. I mean, Stan said that for him failure isn't negative but something to learn from. How easy is that though? I mean, you're talking about learning from something that is a cause of your weekly disappointment.
So, you know, one of my favorite quotes is actually that fear kills more dreams than failure ever will, because if you don't try, you won't succeed. And if you fail, you learn, you tried, you gave your best. And that's at some point, all you can do, not every day you wake up and you're at 100%. Sometimes you wake up at 60% and you have to work for that extra 20% because maybe that day you won't reach 100%. So how many days a year you play picture-perfect tennis? Maybe one day a year, 2 days? The rest, you have to find solutions. You have to work for it. So failure, it's a mindset thing to accept it, to work around it, to try and be the best version of yourself, and that's all you can do.
So did you find that when you lost matches, that you allowed yourself an hour or two to feel disappointed and then said, right, what have I learned from this? And actually see it as a good thing?
No, and I sometimes still find it difficult. Depends if you lose 7-6 in the third and you're on the verge of having a mental breakdown because, you know, all the pressure falls off and you're like, why did I not put that ball there? And you kind of dream about it at night because that's what you do. It's your job. It's your life. It's tennis, you know. So it's tough to kind of be like, okay, deal done. Let me focus on something else. But you do have to have the mindset to be like, look, I love this game. Let me try and get better. Let me learn from this. Let me go practice the next day and improve.
So what advice would you give to your younger self?
To have definitely enjoyed it a bit more. I mean, don't get me wrong. I did enjoy and I'm still enjoying and I still love playing. But to see things with a calmer mindset, to just trust the process and work hard every day and not worry about what could have, what should have, and just be in the moment.
And would your younger self have listened to you?
I hope so.
That's the question, isn't it?
That's a good one.
Before we go, let's throw the spotlight on the doubles. At this year's Australian Open, the men's doubles final included an unlikely pair of Hugo Nies and Jan Zielinski. They lost to Rinky Hijikata and Jason Kubler, but to show it was no fluke, the Monegasque-Polish combination won the title in Rome a couple of weeks ago. Our reporter Candy Reid sat down with Nies, a 32-year-old born on the French shores of Lake Geneva, but now representing Monaco, and asked him to explain his route to becoming what he is this week, the 14th best doubles player in the world.
I started in the futures, you know, Futures Circuit, then Challenger, and then ATP. And I started to play doubles only 5 years ago. I've been playing on the third category tour for a while, and then finally I got into the top 100 in doubles. And now I'm 32, but you know, like, I feel young, and I would not change anything.
So at the start, you said you started playing doubles as full time, really, 5 years ago. Before that, was it all about singles?
I mean, the main focus was singles. I was playing doubles too, you know, like everybody plays singles and doubles, but the main focus was on singles, and then I changed, yeah.
You're from France and you represent Monaco. There seems like an awful lot of French players, particularly male players, now coming through the system. What do you put that down to?
Yeah, we have a lot of French. We used to have a lot of top 10 players in France. But yeah, it takes time. You know, the new generation is coming with Bonzi, Rinderknecht that are one of my best friends, you know, and they're slowly coming, but they will come. And I think French Federation, they have a lot of players, and it's going to be good for the future.
France always have a very good tennis system. When I was younger, I went and played money tournaments over there, and it just seemed like there was so many opportunities. Does that help?
Yes, there are so many opportunities, and we have a slam too, you know. So when you are a child, you just want to go and play Roland Garros, you know, so... But yeah, I mean, you know, in Europe, we have a lot of tournaments, prize money tournaments, opportunities. So, yeah.
Who was an idol for you growing up?
Roger.
Roger Federer?
Yeah.
Any French players? Or just Roger?
Yeah, of course. I mean, all those past 10 years, top French players, I was loving it. You know, I was watching them. But really, my idol were Roger and André Agassi. Yeah.
Oh,
And the Bryans in doubles. Obviously, the Bryans are my idols.
Oh my gosh, have you had a chance to meet them and talk to any of those idols?
Yeah, I had the chance to play against them twice. Unfortunately, I lost in Monte Carlo with a match point, actually. It was a tough time, but you know, I got to meet them a few times, a lot of practice together, and they are really, really nice guys, and they actually gave me some good advices, so yeah.
Can you reveal what the good advice was from the Bryan brothers?
Yeah, no, they told me... They love how I play now, like ripping the ball all the time with my backhand. So they just told me to keep doing it, and that was actually good to hear this from them. You know,
they had a playbook, didn't they, of over 100 plays where they would say a word and they'd know exactly where to move. and what to do. Now, of course, you don't have a twin brother you're playing with, so that doesn't help so much. But do you have a doubles sort of idea like that, where you work with your doubles partner?
Yeah, we're working on it. You know, it's been less than a year that we play together, so we still have a lot to do. But I think we get along pretty well because, we depends on who we're playing. We kind of adapt, but also we have our very specific things to do, and it's working against everyone. So, yeah.
So you're working and playing now with Jan Zielinski of Poland. Before that, you've played with Tim Putz. How do you find a doubles partner? What works best with the person next to you?
It's not easy to find a good doubles partner, I would say. It's like in life, you know, to find a partner is not easy because you have to get along on the court, off the court. When you lose tough matches, you have to stay together, you know. And it was not easy. I mean, it's 5 years on the tour on doubles, and it's the first time that I actually built something big with someone. You know, we hired a coach, and we're going full power together. I think we did right.
Is that because you're ripping your backhand? Does that help?
Yeah, that helps. And he's doing the same.
He's doing the same. But what about the forehands?
Same.
Just, you know, gently ripping hitting the
ball.
Forehand and ripping
every
the backhand. Balls. And yeah. Do you have a system where one is particularly dominant at the net and one plays more from the baseline? One does kind of the hard job and one does the flashy put away stuff?
No, we actually a bit similar.
And what about the half volleys and the little touch stop?
No, actually, I'm very good. I mean, I think I'm good at the net. Yanis, I mean, we are very different players, but also we have the same skills. So I wouldn't say I have a better volley or he has a better voice.
Is there one of you who's the leader on the court more so than the other?
No, 50-50.
50-50?
I'm a bit his big brother because I'm 5 years older. But still, I'm his partner. You know,
yeah.
I don't have to be his coach or whatever just because I have more experience. You know, we have a coach. If he needs to tell him something, he's telling him something. I'm not coaching him, you know. He's my partner.
So you share a coach?
We share a coach.
Does that mean you pay equally?
Yeah.
Okay. And how did you find the coach?
He's Mariusz Fürstenberg. He was a top 10 doubles player, and he's the Polish Davis Cup captain. So it was really easy to find, actually.
Yeah, top 10. He was a very good doubles player. And how does he help you in your doubles?
You know, we wanted someone that could talk to us about big stages, big moments in tournaments, and he played final in US Open. We wanted someone that have a very big experience, you know, so he's just, we're working, you know, and he's, when we have a question on something we don't know, he's here to answer.
How's your Polish?
It's very bad. I know three words.
Do you speak in English then, or what language
do you? Yeah, we speak English, yeah.
Okay, and what about on the court?
English.
Okay. And what language do you swear in?
English, actually, most of the time. Or French when I don't want to have a court violation.
Okay, fair enough. So you've had a great year with Jan. What do you see happening in the future? What's the plan?
Now we are, you know, it's tough in doubles. If you're not in the top 30, you cannot play the Masters 1000. So it's tough to schedule everything. And now, obviously, we're going to have a clear schedule till the end of the year. So we're just going to play the biggest tournaments and... In the end of the day, we want to win the slams, not the thousand. So.
And finally, as a boy, could you ever imagine that you'd be in this position?
I always dreamed about it. So I guess, yeah, you know, I always dreamed about it. I told to myself, just keep working and do everything you can till the end, and maybe these good things will happen to you. You know.
Hugonis, merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. See you.
I love that answer. Did you dream about this? Yes, it was what I dreamed about as a kid. I mean, that's what dreams are for, isn't it? But very few people actually end up realising them. That was Hugonis, and I feel compelled to add that backhand that he rips is one-handed. Not that I'm biased towards the one-handed backhand. Interesting, Tamira, that he talks about the importance of France having a Grand Slam tournament. Importance in terms of developing players. Now, you grew up in Austria, where you have well-established tour events like Linz for the women, Kitzbühel for the men and others, but no Slam. Did you and your fellow promising juniors look with envy on the four Grand Slam nations?
Not really. I mean, I think it's super helpful to have a big federation like the French Federation with a Grand Slam. It just helps players grow up in a tennis environment, the whole federation process of how the training is scheduled and how the tournament, the chances of participating at a slam are way bigger. And also the motivation is bigger for us I'm from a small town in Dornbirn on the west side of Austria. The national center is in Vienna, so that was never an option of moving there. But I do think that countries such as France, England, US, I mean, they have great facilities, and tennis is just at a very high standard also because of those Grand Slams.
And I suppose people from around the world go to America, especially the college system, so they make use, whatever their nationality, of the facilities that the USTA can help fund.
Exactly.
Nisa and Zielinski are currently number one in the race to Turin. In other words, they're the top pair on this year's form, but the top seeds here in Paris will be Kulhoff and Skupski, followed by Ram and Salisbury, with the defending champions Arevalo and Roger in the mix. Any thoughts, Tamira, on which pair has good reason to be hopeful?
One that you actually didn't mention. I think Bopana and Ebden have been playing outstanding tennis. They won Indian Wells and they've been playing really well now, even during the clay court season. So why not include those?
Why not indeed? I hope that Kulhoff and Skupski do well, and I'll be rooting for them, but they're partly because Skupski's from Liverpool and I grew up near Liverpool. So there we go. So that wraps up this week's podcast and our preview of Roland Garros 2023. My thanks to Tamira Paszek, who I hope we'll see in the main draw this time next year. Thanks also to the voices you heard from the ATP players Stefanos Tsitsipas, Holger Rune, Stan Wawrinka and Hugo Nys. If you want to follow the French Open on radio, you can find Radio Roland Garros on rolandgarros.com, featuring many of the voices you've heard on atptour.com over recent years. And to keep up to date with all the live action, head to the ATP WTA Live Scores app. And for more great features and video, head to the ATP website, atptour.com. I'm Chris Bowers. Thanks for listening. And join me and the ATP podcast team again next weekend when we'll review week one of the action here in Paris. In the meantime, enjoy the tennis.